Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound, it's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to the award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This morning, we're opening with the Connecticut Interagency Drought Work Group, which recently lifted its standing drought emergency for the state, and we'll learn why it's still critical to be aware of and to be conservation-minded when you're turning on the tap or otherwise tapping into your private well or municipal water supply. Then we'll do an early stage check-in with a specialist from the Western Connecticut Health Network, who's heading up an important research study to determine why so many individuals suffering from diabetes also end up eventually being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And we'll close with a few wise words for caregivers from Mike Makniak. He's the founder of Guardian Ad Litem Services and a national coach and consultant to caregivers. He'll be talking about his recent paper, The Five Myths of Caregiving. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. Get Healthy CT, a community coalition that works providing information about being healthy and local resources to support healthy eating and physical activity, is hosting a National Dance Day celebration on Saturday, July 29th on Paradise Green in Stratford at the corner of Main and Huntington Roads, or the Star Factory at 3520 Main Street in case of rain. The free event features demonstrations by local dance studios, prize drawings, and health and wellness information. Donations of healthy food items will also be collected for local food banks. If you'd like more information or to find out all the healthy information that you need for yourself and your family, visit GetHealthyCT.org. Longtime listeners may remember back about 4 or 5 years ago where we spent the entire year focusing on protecting and preserving Connecticut's water resources. And more recently, our sit down with Pura Commissioner Jack Bekoski, who talked about this Connecticut Interagency Drought Work Group. And recently, the group met to review current conditions across the state and determined that Connecticut's drought advisory, which was issued last summer and had been issued in years prior, could be lifted. So we wanted to talk a little bit about the lead up to this, what it means, and why everyone should still be mindful of how they use and potentially could be abusing their privilege, tapping Connecticut's water resources. And so we have made the call to the Connecticut Department of Public Health and are now on the line with their drinking water section chief, Lori Matthew. Lori, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So first of all, give us a little bit of an overview, if you would, of the working group.
Yes, the group known as the Interagency Drought Work Group has been around for a very long time. Over the decades, has produced a drought preparedness and response plan, and that is in the middle of being updated at this point. Mm-hmm. The Interagency Drought Work Group is made up of six state agencies and two federal agencies that provide assistance. So it's with and we work in a partnership together. Over the decades. So the Department of Environmental Energy and Environmental Protection, mm-hmm. the Department of Public Health that I'm part of, the Department of PURA, the Public Utility Regulatory Authority, mm-hmm. which Jack Bekoski is the vice chair of,
yes.
Department of Agriculture, the Office of Emergency Management, the Office of Policy and Management, known as OPM.
OPM, yeah.
And in assistance with the USGS, and their offices in Connecticut out of East Hartford, mm-hmm. and NOAA out of their offices in Massachusetts. We all work together as a team and are responsible to track a variety of different measures and metrics. In particular, there are 7 metrics that are kept track of. We meet quite often, and we meet much more frequently when there is a if there is a drought pending or there are dry conditions. We get together quite often and periodically and update information. Even when there is not a drought situation, we are updating information on the Connecticut Water Status webpage, which we all input data into and keep that up to date on an ongoing basis.
Great. What is your tenure with the work group?
Oh, I've been around for a long time, so I'm approaching my 30th year with the health department. I have not been involved directly for 30 years, but I would say since the late 90s I've been participating, and since about maybe for the last 12 years I've been the department's representative, the health department's representative on the interagency drought group.
Okay, so even in that dozen years or so, have there been equal periods where there were drought emergencies and where there were years, periods of a year or years where the weather patterns yielded a kind of a robust output of precipitation to the extent that, not that you met less, but that, you were able to concentrate on, housekeeping and other administrative and scientific tasks because you weren't constantly kind of keeping your eye on the red meter you are when there's a drought.
Yes, there in the drought plan itself, just historically, to take a look back and why the group was pulled together at one point in the 80s, there was a very severe drought that hit the state of Connecticut in the mid-60s, from 1964 to 1968, was a period of 4 years, which there was very low precipitation. I think the year 1965 is one of the lowest years on record. Hmm. And so after that 4 years, there were quite a few things put into place. And then there was another drought in 1981, then again in 1987, and then 2002. After the drought of 2002, the interagency group produced the plan, the drought response plan, which you see up on our webpage now, which is dated August 2003. And ever since August of 2003, from that time period moving forward over the last 14 years or so, we've gone through cycles, periods of dry, periods of excess precipitation. But the plan has always guided us since that time, and the plan has really held true and in the metrics that we use. And but however, as time has evolved, there are other like the drought monitor, for instance, is a great tool that we're looking to add into our toolbox and to add into the state's planning concepts. So we are right now, we've actually under Jack Bukowski's guidance, we've taken public comment for a period of 6 months on our existing plan from 2003. We have received those comments and are now making our staff from various agencies here are making adjustments to the plan as we speak, as a matter of fact. Yeah. We're talking about adjusting it, and it's not a static plan. It's a very dynamic, as you can imagine, a very dynamic plan. We have to make adjustments as time goes on, as we learn more about what is most important, and especially with, call it whatever you want, climate change, extreme weather events, if you don't believe in climate change, but certainly the storms that we've gone through that have had brought extreme weather to Connecticut, I certainly can see that things are somewhat changing. You're having more extreme weather events. You're having times of dry period. Now, we're not seeing more dry periods than historically, but we certainly are seeing extreme weather events that can cause water resources to act differently.
Sure.
And so you might have reservoirs that, on an average over the last 30 years have acted in a certain way, but maybe acting slightly differently now. And those differences in temperature and precipitation affect water quality. And you may have, and now as time and science has moved on and water quality testing has moved on, one of the things the health department here does is we oversee all public water systems statewide. And there's over 2,500 public water systems. One of the responsibilities of my engineers and analysts here, that we have about 45 staff that oversee these systems and oversee water quality information from all of those public water systems, comes into electronically into our database here. And we are responsible to make sure the water companies are doing what they're supposed to do and get all that information into us. Now, over time, there are new contaminants that are coming up, the cyanotoxins, different types of things that could be temperature-related or temperature extreme related. Speaking of Jack, he's on the phone. He's on my cell phone. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
So the there are There's a lot of concepts within the existing drought plan, and we are looking to make adjustments as the last 14 years have moved forward to make sure that we are tracking the correct measures. And certainly the drought monitor is something that we're going to be looking at as one of our tools, probably that's going to be right up front that we're going to be using
a good tool,
moving forward. A very good tool.
Yeah, a good tool to have. Folks, if you're just tuning in to the broadcast this morning, we're very fortunate to have the opportunity to connect with Lori Matthew. She is the drinking a public health section chief for the drinking water section for the Connecticut Department of Health. The Connecticut Department of Health is one of seven state and federal agencies who are part of an interagency drought work group, which just recently ended. They have the authority to call for and then end drought emergency status here in the state of Connecticut, which just occurred. So and we're about a little over halfway through our chat. So let's get into the drought advisory. As an entity, and what does it mean? Or was I incorrect in what I just said? I'm assuming the interagency drought work group does have that authority to at least advise that one of these drought emergencies be called, right, Lori?
Yes, that is one of the work responsibilities of the interagency group is to, as we've just talked about, tracking the metrics that are the responsibility under each agency, putting that information together and moving forward, adding it to the web page. Now, when we start to see some of these metrics going awry, we start to meet much more frequently, and we start to put together that information, and we sit down and go through each metric in great detail. Then we put together, if we start to see, and we based upon our plan, we start to see we're approaching the measures, and there are very specific measures, you know, if 10% of that, 20%
right.
of this, you know, we could get into the details, but I won't bore you with all of that.
Yeah.
But there are seven basic measures that we have to track.
Okay.
And based upon a metric that if we get to a certain point, we are to advise through OPM, the Office of Policy Management, to the governor's office and to the governor where we are at. And what our suggestion is and our advice based upon all of the measures and where our plan is, on what should be, you know, what our recommendations are.
Mm-hmm.
The first, there are four stages. There's the advisory stage, and that's where we got into, actually the second stage. We actually got into the watch stage in the fall of last year. Because of the measures and because of the lack of precipitation and because we were seeing, the groundwater, and specifically groundwater in particular, was quite low, and precipitation was in deficit, and we had many of our measures were rapidly approaching.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing, Lori, is that even though this very educated and capable representatives on the Interagency Drought Work Group have crossed the metrics threshold, so to speak, to remove the drought warning, that does not dismiss the responsibility on the part of anyone listening to this program, certainly if possible, any Connecticut citizen consumer of water, still needs to be aware of the need to practice conservation, right?
Yes, absolutely. Water conservation should be an ethic, an everyday ethic. Wasteful use of your water resources and your water supply is something that is obviously, it should be taken seriously. And there are some basic things that everybody can do, whether you're on a public water system and getting water from a water company or your town's municipal system or a small community system, or you're on your private well. There are some basic things that citizens, anybody can do to save water and to not waste water.
Mm.
And we're working under, I don't know if Jack had mentioned it to you, but we are working on a state water plan.
Mm.
And
yes.
A draft.
Yeah, we'll be having him on as soon as that water plan work with some of your agencies is done. We're targeting having him back probably early to mid-August.
Excellent. So the state water plan, one of the many measures and one of the many implementation items is to focus on water conservation and water efficiency and being being efficient with the use of our water supplies and maintaining high quality water for human consumption.
Yes.
But not wasting that water supply. And that goes to the heart of sometimes the outdoor irrigation and the using water treated, high quality treated water. Highly tested, highly regulated water supply. It's regulated by ourselves and PURA and DEEP and a number of other agencies for irrigation purposes. So one tenet of the state water plan that's going to be in draft in the next couple of weeks out for public comment will be that water conservation should be an ethic. It should water efficiency, using water wisely, should be in everybody's mind. Mm. While we've always been known as, Connecticut has always been known as a water-rich state. We're water-rich. There's plenty of water here. Well, I mean, that is true. We do get average of 42 inches of precipitation every year. However, that water supplies and drinking water in particular should not be wasted.
Squandered,
not
sure.
Be wasteful.
And
there are some basic things. And there's some information on the department's webpage that might be useful for people to take a look at. We've worked really hard to keep it up to date. So if you go to the department's webpage, there is there's a number of tools that people can go to, whether you're on a private well or on a public system, to look at some of the details there.
So is that a ct.gov slash... something?
It is.
What is
right.
It
is. Yeah, it's the web. We can get you the information, but it's if you just Google the Connecticut Department of Public Health,
yep,
and in particular the drinking water section.
Oh, okay. So they
can
just go
to
ct.gov/dph and go to the water conservation tab.
Correct.
Yep, good.
Correct.
Excellent.
Yep.
Well, I don't want to wrap up here. We're about to hit the mark, but we've got about a minute or so left. This will be more of a DEEP interview companion, but the effects of this drought, we've already heard from other experts talking about the proliferation of ticks. We're seeing that there's issues with gypsy moths. When you talked earlier about sort of the direct relationship between the period of drought that triggered the warning and now the after effects that may linger for years, certainly this is proliferations of insects seemingly suddenly are part of the effect.
Well, that's something that our department, my section in particular, I don't oversee that here in the drinking water section. But certainly drought can have an effect, have many, many effects on other parts of the environment and other things. So certainly the Department of the Connecticut Agriculture Experiment Station,
yes,
out in New Haven would probably be the best place,
resource
to reach out to. We can get you some information, contact information there if you'd like. But certainly drought on our public water systems, if I may, the larger public water systems, there are about 85 of them that serve about 2.9 million people across the state. You know, during the drought, each water system has their own emergency contingency plan and drought triggers that are in addition to what the state does at the state level. So each plan has been around for 30 years. It's a state planning requirement, and each utility is responsible to make sure they are tracking their reservoirs, their water, their wells, and to make sure that's reported to the health department.
Good.
When in the second stage of the drought during this fall, the health department is required. One of the triggers that we moved into...
Got about 30 seconds.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. We're required to track, the health department's required, along with the utilities, are required to track about 40 different metrics on water supply and water sustainability. So we are, as we get further into the drought, the health department is working with the water utilities to make sure they have sufficient supply to meet demands, and they are looking to reduce the demands and any waste of water so that we have sufficient supply for fire protection and for human consumption and critical customers.
Yeah. And bringing us back to the importance of going to ct.gov/dph and checking the water tab so that you can get a lot of information about how to conserve water. Connecticut's drought advisories or drought emergencies have occurred 2002, 2007, 2010, and in 2016, the latest advisory and warning has been lifted by the Interagency Drought Work Group, which involves our guest this morning, Larry Matthew, who is the section chief at the Connecticut Department of Public Health's Drinking Water Section. We want to thank you, Larry, for being part of the program and giving us this kind of crash course in water science. We talk a lot about conservation, but have little deep diving, if you'll excuse the pun, on the actual background as to why it's important and the ramifications and implications of the kind of ins and outs and the way that the tide kind of comes in and goes out on water emergencies here in Connecticut. So thank you very much. A very informative chat with this morning. Thanks. All right. Well, with all the fun of the 4th of July past us now, as we send this interview out here in early July, we want to recognize some of the great work that goes on at our area health centers and collaborations and accessibility to individuals who may want to participate in studies that could yield cures or greater information and resources toward defeating things like the heinous disease of pancreatic cancer, one of the many types of cancers. Pancreatic cancer is about the most deadly and difficult to diagnose, and in an effort to detect the cancer at a curable stage, our partners at Western Connecticut Health Network are in the process of rolling out a new study to see if there's a link between diabetes and pancreatic cancer. With us today is oncologist Dr. Richard Frank with the Western Connecticut Health Network. We practiced a lot before the show to not call him Dr. Richard, but Dr. Frank. Dr. Frank, tell us a little bit more about yourself and the Western Connecticut Health Network.
I'm a full-time oncologist, hematologist, who came to Norwalk Hospital in 2000 after being at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, where I was also an oncologist and researcher. And we started a clinical research program here that's now expanded through all the network hospitals. And most recently, we wrote a study to start to answer the question about screening for pancreatic cancer. That's something that's going on throughout our network hospitals, but it's also, we hope to accrue up to 800 individuals with recent onset diabetes mellitus. Of course, we'll talk about that and why that is. But anyone is eligible to join the study.
Well, we'll get into the specifics and criteria in a couple of moments. But I did notice that you have a crossover specialization in both hematology and oncology, and at the Whittingham Cancer Center down at Norwalk Hospital. Well, tell us a little bit about how the crossover of those two specialties complement each other and help you do even more better.
Well, that's interesting, because not every oncologist is a hematologist. And so I think it helps in the sense of understanding bone marrow function, tolerability of chemotherapy drugs in terms of their effects on bone marrow. And, of course, cancer can produce many side effects in the body in terms of lowering blood counts, but also causing blood clots. And so as a hematologist, we're perhaps more experienced in managing the blood cancer complications of cancer and especially its treatment. We have a different perspective, maybe a little broader.
Hmm.
Kind of cross-fertilize each other.
Yeah, very interesting. So this is a $2.7 million three-year research study to investigate the link between new-onset diabetes and pancreatic cancer. What was the kind of the inspiration or the spark point for initiating this study?
Watching too many people die of pancreatic cancer.
Okay.
And basically saying, I'm sick of this. I cannot just continue as we are doing, which is making incremental progress. The disease is quite complicated at the scientific level, and also biologically, it seems that pancreatic cancer, as soon as it becomes over 1 or especially 2 centimeters, which is still less than an inch, sends cells throughout the body, so it metastasizes, which means it's incurable, which is why the cure rate is so low. And even if it's, so most people do not have it caught at that stage. But at that stage, there are reports, and we all know, that if people are lucky to have it caught very early, there is a substantial survival.
Mm. So it sounds like you're describing what, I guess, from a layman's standpoint, I would maybe describe as a red zone that people need to really be aware of and careful about once they've been diagnosed with new onset diabetes. Is there a greater proximity to the onset where pancreatic cancer risk statistically is shown to be greater?
Yes. Soon after a diagnosis of diabetes in an individual over 50 years of age, there is a spike in the risk of pancreatic cancer that is highest in the first 3 years after the diagnosis, especially the first 2 years. After that, it drops off to a low-level increased risk, which has always been known for individuals with diabetes for many years. But only recently has it been more appreciated that it's that soon after that diagnosis, that's the period at which those individuals who have diabetes that are destined to undergo pancreatic cancer, that's the period of highest development. And, of course, there are so many more diabetics than there are individuals with pancreatic cancer. And so there's a big quandary, how do you screen all diabetics for pancreatic cancer? That's not practical. And I don't think that will happen. What's happening is, as a pancreatic cancer develops, it produces insulin resistance, and a different type of diabetes, even though it's called type 2 or rarely type 1, it's really classified as type 3. It's a different mechanism. The bottom line is individuals will be diagnosed with diabetes by their primary care doctor, and even though it's so the pancreatic cancer in certain cases is the responsible agent for the diabetes, not the usual causes of diabetes for the general population.
Are there a lot of situations that either you've seen yourself or heard of where individuals are actually at the point where they're being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer without even knowing that they have diabetes?
At least 50% of individuals, by the time they're diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, will have diabetes. And I think overall about 25 to 40% of new diabetics, regardless of stage, new pancreatic cancer patients, regardless of stage, will have a prior history of diabetes. The trick is, which diabetics are at risk for pancreatic cancer?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the then getting into the study, a little bit deeper into the weeds of the study. Who are you looking for, and how are you rolling out the protocols of the study?
Right. So we hope to enroll approximately 800 individuals with new onset diabetes as defined by hemoglobin A1C values. And there are other criteria, because another scourge of the population is something called prediabetes. And there are many millions of people who are told that they have prediabetes, and those individuals can gradually become diabetic. We don't think that the gradual change is consistent with a high risk of pancreatic cancer. So if someone has prediabetes, they need a greater hemoglobin A1C once they're diagnosed with diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking for that real spike, you know, that this something is different here in glucose regulation.
Hmm.
And so that also, if there's a family history of pancreatic cancer, you know, we're allowing slightly lower hemoglobin A1C levels.
Oh, okay.
So we're kind of intermixing the risk of a family history with diabetes as well.
What will participants in the study have to go through? And is it some sort of spaced out interview over the period of time that they're in the study, or do they actually undergo some sort of testing, blood draws? What are the criteria? What would people who might hear the program and want to come to the study because they're within that 3-year window of diagnosis, what will they expect to undergo in terms of the mechanics of the study?
Right. Basically they meet with a research nurse who's in charge of the study. She talks to them, takes a history, elicits a family history. If there's a suggestion that the cancer could be in the family, they are referred to a genetics counselor, and they undergo blood sample for genetic testing, which we will also provide the cost for, finance that.
Hmm.
That's a one-time thing. But then in the study, every 6 months, they will just meet with the nurse, talk to her, see how they're doing, take a blood sample to be frozen to create a serum biobank of individuals before they get diabetes. So if we can have a large bank of individuals with serum of those who developed pancreatic cancer, and we have their blood a year, 2 years, 3 years before, then we can participate and help in the diagnosis and the discovery of a blood test early. That's the ultimate goal, right?
Yes.
To make it easy for people to diagnose those at high risk of pancreatic cancer through a blood test and then put them through the MRI test or other screening methods. So the patients will get an annual MRI. They'll get injection of IV contrast, and they will do that at baseline and then annually for 3 years if all is well.
Very good. Folks, if you're just tuning in, we're having a great conversation with Dr. Richard Frank. He's director of clinical cancer research for Western Connecticut Health Network. We're talking about a study that's trying to establish a link between diabetes and pancreatic cancer. We're going to take a brief break and come back and talk more with Dr. Frank about early detection and how it improves pancreatic cancer survival, why it's so difficult to diagnose pancreatic cancer, and we'll remind you how you can get involved in this study if you qualify, and how the study is being funded. Doctor, stick with us. Folks on the air, stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment to talk more with Dr. Frank. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The Women's Business Development Council is offering carefully selected programs throughout July and August to help you succeed in business. Check out classes including How to Start and Grow a Food Business, So You Want to Start a Business, How to Talk to Your Kids About Money, Licensing and Registration in Connecticut, Ensuring You're Properly Covered, A Business Plan Boot Camp, Building Your Business with the State of Connecticut. And you can also schedule time with a Women's Business Development Council advisor or the WBDC's personal finance coach. If you'd like more information or details on their summer programs, call 203-353-1750 or just click on ctwbdc.org. Thanks for hanging around, ladies and gentlemen. We're with Dr. Richard Frank, who is with the Western Connecticut Health Network. I was particularly excited to see the announcement of this significant study funded with two $1.7 million, a three-year research study to establish links between diabetes and pancreatic cancer, one of the most heinous types of cancer, and with the goal of perhaps providing an eventual cure or eliminating pancreatic cancer in our lifetime. So, Dr. Frank, tell us about, first of all, why it's so difficult to diagnose pancreatic cancer and about the advantages of early detection.
Right. Well, for any screening test, the success rate depends on, first of all, screening the proper population. So obviously, breast cancer, we screen women. Prostate cancer, men of a certain age. And but there are, so colonoscopies, people of a certain age at a certain interval. Those are successful screening programs. And recently, lung cancer in heavy smokers, they get an annual low-dose CAT scan, and that has been shown to detect the cancer early and save lives. So these are the three critical elements. One, have the proper population screened. Two, be able to detect a cancer when it can be removed. And three, prove that that all leads to improved survivals. You're not just detecting the cancer early, but not impacting on survivals. And these things need to be discovered in pancreatic cancer. This is a study making an attempt to begin with, in addition to the work of others, to try to answer these questions. They are unknown. We don't know exactly which patients should be screened for pancreatic cancer. Should it be the general population? We don't think so. We certainly know those with a strong family history of it. Yes, they are already being screened in many programs. But in the general population, who else should be screened? There is a big emphasis and desire to investigate individuals over 50 with new onset diabetes and to screen them for 3 years. Is that going to yield the success that we want? Will we find early pancreatic cancers? If we do, will they be curable, and will we cure these individuals? That's what we hope to find out. And so pancreatic cancer is difficult to screen for all those reasons. We don't really know who to screen and how to screen and for how long to screen, but this is our attempt to make some inroads into that.
Excellent. Is there a improved survival rate for early detection through imaging?
Yes, in individuals who have a strong family history of pancreatic cancer and have been part of screening programs in the United States and especially in Europe, early cancers can be detected and individuals can be cured. It's not 50%, it's between 25 to 40% survival cure rate with these screening programs.
Very good. As we talk more about the study, this is one of these kind of special things because, you know, the money didn't come from Washington. The money came from not only individuals or an individual family who was touched by this horrible disease, but a local family. Who we probably know if we follow the world of entertainment at all. Can you tell us a little bit about this, the special fund that was set up by James Naughton?
Sure. I cared for Jim's wife, Pamela, who had pancreatic cancer and survived 4 years. And she was just an extraordinarily wonderful woman. Really generous and thoughtful of others and just a special person, you know. And I became close to her, and I actually have just become closer to a lot of my patients with pancreatic cancer. I'm not quite sure why that's occurred. I mean, I'm close to a lot of people, and I befriend patients in different ways, you know, but her in particular. And then after she passed, you know, Jim always said if there's anything he could do to help. And once we decided on this project, he went full bore into helping connect us with individuals with means who are willing to donate. Mm-hmm. And they put on a spectacular tribute to Pamela at the Westport Country Playhouse. That was one of the most moving performances ever.
Wonderful.
And yeah, and they, you know, then they were able to raise a very large sum of money that night. We still need more money.
Sure.
And so listening to this and cares to donate, we definitely need additional funds.
Yeah, and you also need participants.
And participants especially, yes.
Yeah, let folks know what they need to do to get involved if they fall within the criteria and can be part of this study that may eventually see an end to pancreatic cancer, God willing.
Yeah. If they've been diagnosed with diabetes and are over 50, the diabetes in the past year, they should call 203-852-3551. That's Tammy Lowe is the nurse's name. And they can come from anywhere as long as they can visit us every 6 months for a visit and an MRI. We will be in contact with their primary care physicians. We rely on the primary care physicians to perform any necessary blood work. We don't want any extra costs to patients, so there is no cost. But that's generally who we are looking for.
Very good. Well, doctor, it's been a great education, and I hope I'm talking to you in 4 or 5 years, and this study has reached the goal that you and all your colleagues, both the Western Connecticut Health Network and others collaborating toward this end, can celebrate the end of pancreatic cancer, or at least the ability to diagnose it in our lifetime and to prevent this heinous form of cancer from taking more lives. Like you see in your patients and like I've experienced in my circle of loved ones. Dr. Richard Frank is the Director of Clinical Cancer Research for Western Connecticut Health Network. He is overseeing this study between trying to establish the link between diabetes and pancreatic cancer. If you'd like to learn more, you can always visit the network's website at WCHN.org for Western Connecticut Health Network. Dr. Frank, great to meet you, and we will be talking to you again soon. Thanks for all your time. Well, we're going to wrap up the program this morning with a long and dear friend, Attorney Mike Makniak, who you've heard on our program a couple of times before, a number of times, actually. And he's actually invited us down to his offices in Naugatuck, the offices of Guardian Ad Litem Services, better known as Melissa's Project. But Mike has also developed quite a skill set in his work with these nonprofit causes, and he is now a national coach and consultant to caregivers. What caused me to give him a call for our program this morning is he recently published an article called The 5 Myths of Caregiving. So, Mike, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us. And tell us a little bit about this kind of conversion to national coach and consultant to caregivers and what prompted you to write this article, 5 Myths of Caregiving.
Well, first of all, thanks, John. It's good to hear your voice again, as always. And thanks for having me on. You know, our work in the nonprofit that I've run since 2002 has focused a great deal around people with mental incapacities dealing from mental illness, from like schizophrenia or any kind of mental illness along those lines, to cognitive illnesses such as dementia, Alzheimer's, etc. And one of the big pieces that we're missing, I think, in the healthcare industry today is an understanding of what goes on in the mind of people who are in a position where they are caring for another person, be it professionally. You know, there are professional fiduciaries out there who are acting as a conservator or guardian, or even, you know, how many people do you know and do I know who are taking care of their parents or another loved one, or God forbid, a child. And there's a lot of stressors that go on in our lives around caregiving. Mm. We have enough to do to keep ourselves in check and going, you know, moving forward. Then when we find ourselves thrust into a situation where we need to care for another, it becomes overwhelming, it's daunting, it's tireless, and very often it's unappreciated.
Mm. So in your experience, you've been able to see some of the things that can go wrong or that can complicate or sidetrack the process, or at least the best quality outcomes of caregiving. And in reviewing your article, I really kind of it struck me that you were first pointing out the fact that for a lot of caregivers, mental incapacity is treated much like any other illness, when maybe individuals who are engaging in caregiving for an individual with mental incapacity really need to kind of hone a different skill set.
Yeah, I think one of the things that jumps out at you after doing this work for a long time and then talking with people who are in the caregiving capacity is they want a cure. And they want to be able to go into the doctor and have the doctor put a cast on something or give you a shot or give you a prescription.
Right.
And it's very frustrating for people of all relationships, be it, you know, family members or whatever, to understand that people with mental incapacities are typically not going to be, quote-unquote, cured overnight. There is no quick fix. Instead, you will wind up going through a very complex and complicated system, and we, as caregivers and providers, really need to take the bull by the horns and be proactive team leaders. We need to be the catalyst for change that's going to bring about help to the people that we're caring for or that we love.
Mm. And I understand one of the barriers to that is in certain cases where care providers are not allowed to get confidential information that they may need to do the best job on behalf of their charge.
Yeah, well, there's always the issues of confidentiality and privacy. We in our American society have kicked it up a notch into this monster we call HIPAA, H-I-P-P-A, which is not and was never meant to be this big ugly beast that it has become.
Mm.
We've absolutely translated HIPAA incorrectly, and it's really created roadblocks and hazards for anybody who is trying to provide care for a loved one. One of the important things to point out, though, number one, I believe wholeheartedly in including as many reliable history, you know, tellers that we can with when we're trying to pull together a case scenario or fact pattern.
Sure.
And it never hurts any kind of care provider, be it a doctor, a hospital, a case management organization, whatever, it never hurts them to include the people who know the individual best. So there's nothing to say that those people cannot receive information from me. They may not be able to give information to me, but there's nothing to say that they cannot receive it. And one of the things that I find so frustrating is that this abject refusal to even discuss a case with me. So if I'm calling up and they don't want to discuss a case with me, and they're basically telling me that they're roadblocking me and I'm just trying to give information, that's completely counterintuitive, and it's absolutely flies in the face of good care from my perspective and from theirs.
And I dare say does not necessarily or even frequently fall under the technical protections or stipulations of HIPAA, right?
Well, HIPAA
they pull the HIPAA card all the time.
Yeah, they pull the HIPAA card, exactly. There's an expert in the field, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he says almost invariably, if the question is, does HIPAA apply, the answer is no.
Hmm.
So, yeah, they pulled the HIPAA card, and HIPAA certainly doesn't apply here. And no confidentiality issue applies when it comes to a provider receiving information from somebody else.
Right.
It all goes to them giving information.
And HIPAA has its rightful place and does good
sure.
in its appropriate application. But when it's used as a catch-all for medical people who or individuals that are tied in the medical or care service delivery system who don't want to be bothered to learn the rules, or God forbid, using it as an excuse to just not do the little extra work they need to do to better care for the individual involved, it sort of turns into a travesty. The other thing I wanted to point out, and folks, if you're just joining us here as we start moving toward our music day on the award-winning For the People, we're visiting with our friend Mike Makniak. He's an attorney. He's affiliated with Guardian Ad Litem Services based in Naugatuck, which runs Melissa's Project. And Mike is also a national coach and consultant to caregivers. So he has recently published an article that we're talking about this morning called The Five Myths of Caregiving. And it's interesting, Mike, you and I have both worked for volunteer organizations, and probably something we've heard a lot is that, you know, you've heard the old adage about a woman scorned and hell hath no fury. But how about a volunteer who's scorned? Well, I found it interesting that one of your five myths was this bad decisions are grounds for interference, because a lot of times when a bad decision is made on the part of the person who is kind of driving the bus, the person who's being cared for, sometimes they face either conscious or even unconscious retribution, or at least bad feelings on the part of the caregiver who may not agree with that decision.
Well, there's a whole bunch of dynamics that go on there, aren't there, with regard to that relationship. You know, first of all, caregivers have to understand that no matter, even if you have a fiduciary authority from a court, that does not mean that the person that you are caring for does not still maintain some rights.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those rights are, hey, I can make some bad choices. And my right to make a bad choice is my own, as long as it doesn't interfere with other people and hurt other people. And frankly, as long as it doesn't interfere with your job as my caregiver or my fiduciary.
Mm-hmm.
So there's where the battle comes in. There's where a lot of push and pull comes in. Because, you know, I feel it's important that you, John, have a nice home to live in. But you, John, choose to live under a bridge. This mm-hmm. is what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So to the extent that you are healthy and safe and you understand the choices that you're making, you have a right to make that choice.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, depending on what kind of fiduciary I am, or even if I'm just a family caregiver for you, I don't want to see you living under a bridge. And under certain circumstances, I may have an obligation to find shelter for you.
Right. Right.
So this becomes a real push and pull, and people get, yes, very frustrated with each other. You know, a lot of caregiving becomes a situation where folks feel as if they're being babysat, and nobody wants to be feeling like they're being babysat, particularly people who are, you know, at least over the age of 14, you
sure,
know?
Sure, absolutely. We've only got about a minute and a half left, and I just wanted to reiterate point five on the myths is a strategy should focus around my loved one's disability, which is a kind of explains itself. But in the last minute or so that we have, I would like you to speak to the last point of your five myths of caregiving, and that is an attorney must act in the best interest of my loved one. And speak, please, to the individuals who are kind of co-piloting in between an attorney and a loved one so that
right.
You can kind of orient folks the best way to address an attorney when they feel that attorney is in conflict with what the caregiver understands as the loved one's wishes.
Right. As an attorney, we are obligated to do what our client wants, not what we think our client needs. So John may want to live under that bridge. I may think he does not need to live under that bridge. But as an attorney, I have to go into court and advocate for his right to live under that bridge. I may not agree with John, But my ethical obligation as an attorney is to say, he wants this. This is what I have to advocate for.
Excellent.
It's in complete juxtaposition to a caregiver who is completely looking out for somebody's best interest.
Very good. Caregivers are vital to the health and maintenance of countless people struggling to maintain meaningful lives in our communities all across Connecticut and all across the country. Mike Makniak, our guest this morning, acts in the capacity as a national coach and consultant to caregivers. He's also affiliated with Guardium Ad Litem Services and Melissa's Project in Naugatuck. If you'd like to find out more about him, you can email him at mike@michaelmakniak.com. That's MACKNIAK.com. Or more easily, just visit his website, caregiveracademy.org. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voket@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voket, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.